What I want to do today is spend a little bit of time giving an update on Historic Resources Code Project. The last time I was before you as a commission, I had suggested that the draft code would be out for your review by now. That is not the case. And so I want to take a little time today to talk about some delays we've run into with the legislative process, and then get into a few specifics of where we've made some changes since I last discussed the project with you, and just get you a little more up to speed on the developments there. Because Commissioner Smith is new, I did want to give a brief background about specifically what's included in the project, why we're doing it, and where we're going with it. And I did want to reserve a few minutes at the end to talk about a few related things that are coming out of Bureau of Planning and Sustainability that I think you all should know about. So I don't know, Laura, if it's possible to get us on the screen. So for the benefit of Commissioner Smith, we launched the Historic Resources Code Project about a year ago, or a little over a year ago, with a goal of modernizing the text of the zoning code as it pertains to designated and inventoried historic resources. We started the project off with best practice research nationally, where we looked at 13 comparable cities. We held four sort of town hall roundtable sessions, heard from about 500 people through online surveys, had one-on-one meetings with stakeholders, both internal and external to the city, and spent the better part of the spring and summer developing potential code revisions that would resolve different problems that have been identified, that would incorporate other community goals and objectives into the Historic Resources Code, and develop a better protection scheme for some of the resources that today maybe aren't being adequately protected, or at least that's what we've heard. So we went through that process.
Brandon, I am embarrassed to have to ask you to stop for 1 second, but I have an embarrassing gaffe here. I really meant to say something to our guests from the AHC when they were up here earlier, specifically about Kathy Galbraith, and just acknowledge her importance in the preservation community, and to send you all my very deep sympathy. I think most of us knew her work, knew her personally, and she has really been a force of nature in preservation specifically, and I'm so sorry. Anyway, I didn't want Brandon to go on any further before I mentioned that. Thank you. Sorry, Brandon. Please.
And well, one of the updates I want to provide to the commission is at the end of this discussion has to do with the project that we were actively working with Kathy on.
Of course.
At the time of her passing. So I just wanted to give you an update on that. And okay. What we're thinking about how we will do the impossible task, which is to try to fill her shoes to finish that project out.
Okay.
Anyway, jumping back into the text of the code here. Just for Commissioner Smith, we set out with three primary project goals. One was to revise our process, criteria, and program for updating the citywide historic resources inventory. That's been a commission objective for many, many years now. We've done background study. We have a vision about what the update of the HRI would look like, but there are necessary text amendments in the code before we can begin that process of adding properties to the inventory. Second, we want to look at new state regulations and national best practice in designating historic landmarks and historic districts at the local level. And then finally, we took a comprehensive look at the application of protections, both demolition and design, for historic landmarks, historic districts, conservation landmarks, and conservation districts. And we believe there are a number of opportunities to expand exemptions for minor exterior alterations, and to look more comprehensively at demolition and alterations in the conservation districts and for accessory structures. So effectively being the biggest historic resource code project in about the last 30 years, 25 years in scope. So as I mentioned, we heard from a lot of people. Although our timeline had been optimistic to start, we had a lot more feedback than we expected. And I think the project team, as we started to unravel the sort of large knot, that is some of these issues. We've run into a number of timeline challenges. One of those challenges is that it's a staff of me in the Planning Bureau running the code project as well as all the other day-to-day operations. And so allocating time and resources can be somewhat of a challenge. I'd hope to have a discussion draft of the code out, which would be the first public public draft of the specific language in November. But internally, we have a code editor and a code editing team that is our sort of support system to make sure that the code language that's released for public review is defensible, aligns with the rest of the code, and sort of meets our minimum obligation for having clear and consistent language. We have been slammed with residential infill project, Better Housing by Design, design overlay zone amendments. And so all of our projects are slowly working their way through so that the necessary stops to get out for public review. My hope is that early January and maybe as late as the last week of this month, we will have the discussion draft of the code out for review. I do have an internal copy just to give you a sense of what we're talking about. And it's a sizable document. So along with that, we will have handouts and information that are specific to each resource type, and then more global about the project. So in addition to the specific code language, we will have information for people who might just have a question about what it means for their commercial building, what it means for the district they live in, what it means for their HRI property. And so all that collateral material in addition to the code has taken us longer to develop than expected. So I'm hoping that we'll be out for public review within the month, and probably not much later than that. Once we have the code out for review, we'll schedule public events and feedback opportunities to get broad feedback from the public, both those who would be affected by potential changes as well as those who are interested or have a relationship with planning processes or historic preservation citywide. We'll do those feedback sessions and input opportunities in the sort of winter months, probably wrapping those up in March or so. In the late spring, we'll have taken into consideration all the feedback we've received to see how close are we to the mark, and release a proposed draft. It'll go to the Planning and Sustainability Commission in the summer for hearings, work sessions, and then a recommendation to City Council. And we're hoping that we're on track for a fall City Council adoption process. So the timeline for astute observers continues to sort of push out further. And like I said, there's a variety of reasons for it, but this is our current thinking about timeline. In terms of the amendment theme, some of this commissioners have seen, especially those who have been following us closely, but for the benefit of those who have not, and for our new commissioner, after taking into consideration all that public feedback and sort of working through the code amendments, one of the largest areas of change has to do with the difference between a historic landmark and a conservation landmark, a historic district and a conservation district. We've had conservation resources in the city since the 1970s. In their current form, we've had 6 conservation districts and about 10 conservation landmarks that were designated in the early 1990s. While historic districts and historic landmarks have seen some regulatory improvement and change in the last 20 or 30 years, we haven't comprehensively looked at how successful the protection program for conservation landmarks and conservation districts has been. Upon review, we think there are opportunities to make those conservation resources a more successful part of our preservation scheme here in the city. And so that effort will be a big part of the public discussion is, would a change in regulation in the conservation districts successfully conserve places and address the type of resource that the historic districts haven't addressed. We've also looked across the board at opportunities to eliminate unnecessary reviews by creating new exemptions, and that's what I want to talk with you primarily about today, as well as to refine the review threshold, so projects that are a type 1, type 2, type 3, making some changes there so that property owners or applicants who have very small projects can come in for a type 1 review. Maybe projects that today are being reviewed as a type 1 that ought to have a more robust review process and the ability to be appealed to this commission be a type 2. And so we've made some refinements to the thresholds. And so that for a keen observer is going to be an area of interest, but generally looking at what our partners at Bureau of Development Services and information we received from various stakeholders have told us. Another thing we're seeking to do, and this we've talked about previously, is creating a designation process at the local level that allows for broad public involvement in the establishment of districts and in the designation of individual landmarks, as well as incorporates ethnic, cultural, gender, and community histories as areas of significance for designation. And then the last piece, really looking at adaptive reuse flexibility and the use-based incentives in the code. So we've talked about some of that before, but I did want to give that quick background. Okay, so a couple of things that have changed in our thinking or have sort of matured into the direction that we are going with the code project is really looking at our locally designated landmarks. We have about 80 of those landmarks that are locally designated that are not on the National Register, and 600 or so landmarks that are landmarks by virtue of being on the National Register. Today, only the properties on the National Register are afforded demolition review. Those that have been locally designated are only afforded 120-day demolition delay. There's no opportunity for appeal or denial in demolition delay. And so an area that staff feels is necessary for public discussion is elevating, raising the bar for those places that have gone through that robust local process to incorporate that best practice demolition review. At present, we're not talking about that many landmarks that would see a regulatory change. But going forward with the city's program, if this commission and city council is considering or will be considering new proposed landmarks, having a regulatory program that we know works, that's been tested for the last 13 years here in Portland, and that meaningfully can deter and say no to demolition, we think is an important part of that local program. We also think it's an important discussion to look at detached accessory structures. Today, garages, sheds, outbuildings that are identified as contributing or historic are subject to that same city council demolition review process. Staff will be proposing to make that a type 2 staff level process that's appealable to your commission, but that doesn't burden the city council with reviewing garage demolitions. We'd be establishing a new relocation review. And then generally retaining discretionary review as it exists today for historic landmarks and historic districts. So, we're not proposing to make changes to approval criteria in that area. We are proposing some exemptions, and I'll talk about those and ask a couple questions of you in a minute. Let's do that now. So the one area that we've been working through and really exercising our brain muscles and sort of code specificity is in the area of exemptions. So for new commissioners or those who haven't worked with exemptions are items that are delineated in the code that are not subject to historic resource review where review is otherwise required. So an exemption is something that if you meet the parameters of that exemption, you don't come in for review. We've heard from a number of individuals, primarily in the historic districts, as well as staff who have reviewed projects that that really fall beneath the line of something that has a negative effect on the historic resource, or are the types of projects that property owners might just do on the weekend and run the risk of having complaint filed or having violated the code. One area we heard quite a bit about, and again, I will be interested in your gut check on some of these as we put the finishing touches on the code language in case there's something that raises a red flag or that you really like. But one area that we've heard repeatedly has to do with the replacement of non-historic windows, primarily vinyl windows, that there's been a lot of interest in historic districts to allow for the replacement of a vinyl window with a wood window within the same opening, not removing historic features, and not coming in for review. So today, if you were to replace one, let's say a vinyl bathroom window with a new wood window, you'd be looking at least a type 1 $250 staff level review to replace that window. We're proposing an exemption that says keep it within the same opening, don't remove historic features, and if you replace that vinyl window with a wood window, you are exempt from review. We're also looking to exempt very small outlets, meters, hoses, conduits, and pipes on non-street facing facades with a number of specific parameters about how far off the ground those conduits, meters and outlets can be, and a few other sort of triggers for each specific thing listed there to allow for things like a new water or gas meter, a small hose that might connect the detached air conditioning unit to the structure, or an electrical outlet that goes to a detached mechanical system of some type. Really thinking about minor exterior changes that aren't noticeable from the street or that aren't discernible and don't harm historic fabric in a meaningful way, that some of those might be good candidates for exemption. We were also thinking that small signs that are 3 feet or less in area that are not mounted to brick or stone, is another opportunity for an exemption. This generally would be in sort of commercial areas, thinking about maybe Northwest 21st or 23rd or the Northwest 13th Avenue Historic District, that allowing for tenants to be able to put up a small sign without the delay and cost of going through the review process could be a way to lessen some of the burden on retail tenants who we've heard from that want a little more expedient process to be able to put up a sign for their new business. We want your feedback on this when you review the specific code language. The proposal wouldn't allow for any electrical components in that sign, and it would allow for it to be mounted to mortar between brick or stone. So there's kind of thought through what would be a way to allow these very small signs without harming historic features. Removal of internal service chimneys. This primarily has come out of Irvington, and a concern that removing a chimney that's only visible above the roof and really is not an architectural element may be an opportunity to not be subject to review for a property owner who is looking to remove the chimney for seismic reasons or reasons of, you know, sort of obsolescence. Minor seismic straps on foundation walls that are painted to match the foundation wall. Exact replacement of driveways, so removing a concrete driveway with a new concrete driveway in the same location. And then one that we've gone round and round about internally, but solar panels on detached accessory structures, thinking about allowing some additional flexibility for solar, but maybe doing it on structures that are primarily farther from the street. Any initial gut thoughts on these exemptions or things that I've mentioned? You'll have to get into the code language when it comes out, but I did want to give you a heads up about some of this direction.
I'll throw one out about the windows. It seems like the premise is that if you have a really bad window, and as long as it's wood, it'll be better than what you're replacing. But would there be any like discretion over the mutton bar configuration, or whether it's a double hung or a casement, or it just as long as it's made out of wood?
So Commissioner Roman's point, that your premise is the premise that we've come into this thinking, that there are a couple of window types that are never found in historic context, or at least the way we've drafted it, that if an owner were replacing that window with a wood window, it would be moving it in the direction of compatibility. Maybe not to the direction that we would require in a staff level review, but the thinking is it wouldn't do any harm. You would be maintaining that baseline or maybe improving upon it.
If every window in the building was a double hung and all of a sudden there was a big plate glass, wood frame, sash, that might, I'm just throwing this out as a topic, so.
But if it was replacing a vinyl, I mean, I guess, you know, the vinyl could be a
be
double
nice
hung, I guess.
If the planner could just have a little discretion, like if it didn't always have to, it's like either it's a land use review or it's anything goes. There's no like.
Yeah.
So anyway.
And I'll look forward to your comments on the specifics of the exemption, because we might be able to get at it a little different way. Another piece too is a cost issue. You know, you want to replace one small vinyl window and you're paying $250 to do so.
Couple quick comments just on the last two bullet points here. Oh, and Commissioner Chung has joined us. Hi.
Hello, my apologies for being tardy. My regular job kept me.
So exact replacement of driveways, I actually wonder if that can be tailored to allow driveways to just have drive strips rather than, you know, the full concreted. So that might be one thing to look at. And then regarding your last bullet point, solar panels on detached accessory structures, would that be solar panels that are flat to the surface or not necessarily? Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. So today, currently there's an exemption in historic districts that allows solar panels on non-street facing roof slopes.
Right.
And those solar panels have to be parallel to the roof plane and set back from edges. We've generally seen that to be pretty successful. You know, they're obscured, they're not evident to passerbys. We've also heard a lot of interest in expanding that exemption to cover more roof planes or roof area. One thing that's happened, or we believe has happened since the time when that exemption was put into place, is that solar panel technology, solar system technology has gotten skinnier. And so we believe there's an opportunity to push that down even a little further to the roof in the exemption, mm-hmm. maybe let it come out a little further than the current required setback from roof edges, that maybe there's a way to get a little bit more room for solar. But internally, we have had quite a few discussions about whether or not it would be appropriate or maybe even desirable to have street-facing solar in historic districts. And it's been a discussion before. This isn't our first rodeo having this debate about solar. The National Park Service and the State Historic Preservation Office maintain that street-facing solar is an adverse effect and that it has an integrity impact. And they've advised us to not allow street-facing solar. Mm-hmm. We have also heard from a number of people in the preservation community that for large districts like Irvington and Ladd's, that maybe solar isn't as bad as it once was, or maybe there's been an acceptance of it as a reversible effect on buildings. And so we've had a number of discussions with different perspectives internally, and have landed on this idea that, well, maybe we can allow a little more flexibility on non-street facing elevations, take up a little more of that roof plane, and then maybe also allow solar parallel to the roof plane, but street visible on detached structures, provided that the detached structure is something like 40 feet back from the street, that it's back of the lot or further back in the lot, and you know, may provide some opportunities for those people who are really seeking solar to have another area they can put in. So I expect and hope we get comments back on that, if that's
right.
Too liberal, if we can go more liberal, or what concerns would be out there with that approach. Certainly garages are not necessarily the optimal place for solar panels in most situations. Usually one-story building.
Although many of them at least have flat roofs, and so you don't get that immediate impact, you know, on the street. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, just thinking about the difference between like a one-story house and how visible that gable end might be on the street versus something that has, you know, more mass and it's higher up. And so it actually kind of becomes a little bit less visible, or at least less of an impact on that overall front.
And that's where there's been a number of recent land use reviews for solar panels in historic districts. South Portland and Irvington have each seen one in the last couple of years. So an item that's not exempt from review could come in for review. And we have seen that with some solar systems that say, well, this doesn't meet the exemption, but we still feel like because of the site conditions, because of the roof form, that it's approvable. And in some cases, staff have approved those that don't meet the exemption.
Okay. Well, this will be interesting as it develops.
Is there a copy of the text? Because your commentary just now seemed to suggest that these solar panels on detached accessory structures would only apply if it was one story. Is that what you said?
Oh, no. Oftentimes, the detached structure is just one story. There are two-story examples out there, too.
But these proposed exemptions are being written into the code, right?
That's right.
So they would have, it sounds like there are additional conditions associated with these. I know that you tried to summarize them into these categories, but it's not as if all solar panels and detached accessory structures would be written into
That's
the
right.
code as being exempt.
That's that, right. There'd okay. be
criteria.
The exemption has sort of standard-like, you know, solar panels that meet these criteria, or not criteria, it's wrong, solar panels that meet these standards
uh-huh.
within, let's say, 8 inches of the roof, parallel right. to the roof plane, not overhanging eaves, that kind of thing.
Okay. So that seems like it would be critical to know those things before we could opine right. about whether or not, because maybe seismic straps on foundation walls are probably okay unless they're somehow injurious to the historic character of the structure,
yep.
right?
Yep. And so all those things are things that I expect this commission will wrestle with in great detail.
And we'll have the opportunity to weigh in as that language develops. And okay.
Well, yeah, and you'll have the discussion draft. So my hope is that the commission in the winter months, and I'm not sure, Chair Minor, how you want to do this, but really does dig into the different pieces and give us thoughtful feedback about the brass tacks, but also the bigger policy direction, because we don't necessarily want to go down a road that the commission's not open to in the first place.
Okay.
Just quickly here, I there's been a little bit of revised thinking about this conservation landmark and district conversation. We're still at the staff level. Intend to release in the discussion draft a new type of demolition review, a staff level type 2 review, that would apply in conservation districts to the contributing buildings and to conservation landmarks. We don't today have a type 2 demolition review. We don't have approval criteria for a type 2 demolition review. So those are things that will float in the discussion draft. Because conservation districts are only subject today to 120-day demolition delay, we have seen a number of demolitions in conservation districts of resources that are contributing or significant to the district, and no public process outside of direct negotiation with the property owner to change that outcome. But conservation districts were intended to, and we still think are useful to be treated differently than historic districts. And so it may be that protecting a conservation district and applying a different type of review for demolition is the appropriate way to go. And we've taken a first draft at what that would look like. And so you'll see that in there. And in the type 2 approval criteria, a little different than what city council considers in a type 4, we'd really be looking at the historic merits of the building and whether the replacement project or in the negotiations about replacement, there can be a mitigation measure that supports either architectural or cultural history in the district. And what that looks like will be a negotiated process during the type 2 staff level review. I think this, again, is an idea we're floating, and we expect to get a lot of feedback on how well it works or doesn't work to meet that expectation that we increase protections in the conservation districts, but we don't facsimile copy what we've done for historic districts. And then again, a type 2 review would be appealable to Landmarks Commission. So I have two more slides here on HRCP. And this one is the area where we've really been doing a lot of thinking, which is how design in conservation districts exists today and how it differs from historic districts. I won't get into great detail today, but I think most people in the room are familiar with, and I think without getting into details on a case, you have one today that falls into this category. In conservation districts, there's a two-track system. So applicants have the path of following design standards that are clear and objective, and the option to follow design guidelines that are discretionary. Some applicants do choose the design guidelines. Some applicants have unique site conditions or unique building that sort of requires them to go the guidelines path because the standards don't work. And what we've seen generally is that the community design standards have done a pretty good job retaining the historic buildings that haven't been demolished. That there have been some changes. There are some examples of projects that maybe weren't preservation best practice, but on balance, at least what staff have seen is that in conservation districts, the historic resources have generally been preserved when they haven't been demolished. What we have seen is that large new infill that follows the community design standards can often greatly deviate from the established patterns of the neighborhood. And this isn't so much about the size or the height or FAR of the structure, but more about the design details and whether or not an approach that meets those standards or intends to respond to the neighborhood through that clear and objective way at a large scale can be successful without a review. And so we're going to ask the question in discussion draft, should there be discretionary design review for projects over a certain size? And we're going to ask that question in a pretty open-ended way. It would be a bigger policy shift, but it's certainly something that we want to get feedback and get community discussion going on is, should we raise the bar on projects above a certain size and require community design guidelines rather than standards? The example on the bottom is a project that followed the standards.
And Brandon, I guess I'm going to ask you your opinion if you think that there is appetite for actually adding more discretionary review in conservation districts.
I think it's a question. And I think that the question is, if conservation districts are intended to be different than historic districts, mm-hmm. they're intended to protect resources in a different way, or maybe a resource type that can accommodate greater level of change than a historic district, thinking about the potential for future conservation districts, thinking about areas of the city that have something special, either a pattern or architectural significance or cultural history, is requiring discretionary review a necessary component to preserving the place? Or do community design standards get us there and it's really about protecting the historic pieces and making new buildings kind of fit in, but leaving a lot of room for deviation? So I don't know. But I think if we, in the discussion draft, hear some consensus and can bring that forward and propose draft with, some clearer direction from the community, that would help inform that discussion. And then ultimately, PSC will wrestle with
that. I'm glad to hear you say that. I think we have been struggling on projects that happen in conservation districts with the disparity between the results on the two tracks.
And I would wonder too, and maybe not every conservation district has guidelines. Maybe some have guidelines and some have standards. Maybe there's an approach that if your building is larger than 4,000 square feet, guidelines kick in. I think we've just gotten to a point where we want to ask the question and just see what we hear before we pick a path. So if it's okay, I want to give an update on a parallel development that I just wanted to give you some information that has come through from Restore Oregon about the 2019 state legislative session and a bill that's being developed, legislative concept that has been publicly announced is moving forward. City of Portland's not drafting the bill. We don't have a position on the bill. City Council has not voted on their 2019 legislative agenda. So what I'm presenting is just what I know from our colleagues at Restore Oregon and Senator Dumbro, who is working on a legislative concept with a work group. I also should say I was invited to participate in legislative this work group that talked about a potential bill. We have not met in a few months, and so there's a bit of a quiet period as bills are being drafted, and so I haven't seen a draft of the bill, and I'm not sure what support looks like or where things exactly are going, but we're tracking it closely, and I think we're expecting something to materialize in the session. I want to talk about this after the code project stuff, because where this bill goes will ultimately change some of the items in the code project if it were to pass or if a version of it were to pass. And so one of the opportunities in our timeline being a little delayed is watchful eyes have been looking at this potential bill and wanting to make sure that processes align. Legislature meets in the winter and adjourns in June. And so if a bill is introduced by June, we would know whether or not something were changing in our local policy environment, what that would look like. That gives us the opportunity if a bill did get introduced and did get passed to amend course in the proposed draft to accommodate things that either are required to do as part of a legislative change or new opportunities that arise. Per an announcement at Restore Oregon, the legislative concept that they're working on would repeal the owner consent law for local designations. So this would be a big change. Since 1995, the legislature has required cities in Oregon to obtain owner consent for landmark designation, and now a majority owner consent for the creation of districts. This would allow community discussions and the opportunity for city councils statewide to make decisions with or without owner support. It would potentially eliminate demolition review for newly listed National Register resources. So today, you put a property or a district on the National Register, it comes with demo review. This would potentially decouple those things. But it would maintain the protections that exist for resources that are listed in the National Register already. The Special Assessment of Historic Property Tax Assessment incentive is set to expire, and the conversation has been about retaining that program or modifying it in some ways that it retained. And there's been quite a bit of conversation about establishing a pilot tax credit or grant program for certain types of projects, primarily seismic and affordable housing projects have been discussed. Again, City of Portland doesn't have a position on this, and this is just a sort of overview of what has publicly been announced. But several of these things, if they did go into effect, would potentially change our direction at the staff level for the code project. So we'll have the discussion draft out for public review. We'll be tracking the legislature closely. I'm sure this commission will be increasingly engaged and aware if that is happening. but also giving us the opportunity to amend course in the proposed draft before it goes to Planning Commission if this came to be.
Did you say Senator Dembro is likely the sponsor of this?
That's right.
So in regards to bullet point number two, don't we need a contingency plan for that one way or the other? Because that's basically the status quo, is there's no design review for future National Register nominations in Portland?
Unless they're locally designated or there's a land use process to add discretionary review to them.
So as part of our code rewrite, is there any effort to address that locally if it's not addressed on a state level?
So what we have in the code in the discussion draft that will go out, and again, we'll get your comments on it, is that resources that are listed on the National Register will only have design review if they're given a corresponding local designation. So if Chair Minor put her factory building on the National Register, it would come with demolition review, and then there would need to be a subsequent local landmark designation to get design review. We are looking at in the code having a streamlined fast process if it's on the National Register to get that local designation. Today, owner consent would be required, so Chair Minor would have to elect to do that. But it would be in the proposal a type one review for the local designation. It would also unlock the incentives. So we're looking at expanding the regulatory incentives, which I've talked about before and didn't want to belabor today, but expanding those regulatory incentives and only offering incentives to resources that are protected with demolition review, type two or type four, and design protections. So if Chair Minor wanted her factory on the National Register to have use flexibility or transfer that FAR, she would need to seek a local designation, which she could do through a type one process.
Right. And I think we have discussed previously in various work projects, all of us, that that the concern would not necessarily be so much on individual resources, which, you know, any owner generally who wants to put up their building to be on the National Register would also want it to come with protections, but more at the district level. And that's where we've had some concerns with perhaps there not being a level of support or understanding of what historic districts do and why it is that those are important themselves. And so having no protections within historic districts, I think it would be harder to get those protections put on resources there.
Have there been any challenges, here, by the way, to that? I mean, just tagging along to that point, Chair Minor's point, isn't there like an equal protection issue? I mean, so basically, if you're an existing National Register listing, you get protections, but if you're a brand new one, you get none. How might a property owner in a new district, has there been any kind, to your knowledge, any litigation brought on that issue?
Not to date, and I haven't seen the draft bill, so I'm not sure how that question is handled.
It's already what we do in Portland, right? And nobody in Eastmoreland or what was the other one?
Well, Eastmoreland is not a historic district.
Not yet.
So I think the only new historic district that's come online is
Peacock Lane. But no one from Peacock Lane has come forward and said anything about that?
No, and state administrative rule would be that's the trigger for that question, which says clearly that resources listed before 2017 can have design protections. Resources listed after 2017 cannot, unless there's a local adoption process.
Can I add one more comment just regarding the special assessment? It seems like the city should advocate for the special assessment program because it helps Multnomah County and Portland citizens. And it's weird we're gonna have this kind of decoupling where it's a, mm-hmm. and I'm curious. So if it's all local listing, is that something City Council could vote to unlist on their own at any time they want? Or, because that's an argument to keep it coupled with a state program where there's some overseeing regulatory body that isn't a political sort of...
One, you'll see retaining special assessment and adding a rehabilitation tax credit in the draft legislative agenda that the Office of Government Relations has circulated citywide for public feedback. So before City Council lands on their agenda for 2019, Government Relations puts out a draft retaining special assessment and seeking additional rehab tax credit dollars is on that draft agenda.
Right.
It'll be up to City Council to choose what to do with that. And then about your question about removals, well, that is true that a local listing can also be removed. The Goal 5 administrative rule provides a pretty tight set of criteria for what would justify a removal.
Okay.
And that those removals would at the local level would need to follow those removal criteria that are in the Goal 5 rule. Generally, those removal criteria in the Goal 5 rule speak to integrity and the qualifications for listing at the time of designation. So when something is designated, if the direction is to remove that building to allow for a reuse, then it should go through a demolition review and be weighed against a comprehensive plan. But if the idea is to remove something just to remove something, Goal 5 says, well, that's not really a sound reason to remove a designation. So we could talk more about that, but that's something that we're putting in the discussion draft of the code to solidify that there would need to be solid rationale before removing a local designation. Demolishing it, sure, if you had a better, you know, a use that was more consistent with the comprehensive plan.
So you're going to have something to send us, a link or something in 3-4 weeks, maybe?
For code?
Yeah.
I hope so.
Okay.
I hope so. It may be that you get a draft of the text, and then a week or two later, we have our public event scheduled. My hope is to move on this as fast as we can, but we've got those internal challenges we're up against.
Okay.
I did want to give you two, if it's okay, Terminator, two other slides about just quick updates about other projects.
Sure.
I'll be fast. As Chair Minor mentioned, Kathy Galbraith passed away a few weeks ago, and Kathy had been working with the city first on a consultant basis and subsequently as a volunteer to help us make revisions to a multiple property documentation form for African-American historic sites. For those of you who don't know, Kathy and the Architectural Heritage Center worked in the late 90s and early 2000s on the Cornerstones of Community project, which documented resources primarily in North and Northeast Portland significant in the African-American experience. And that Cornerstones documentation has been used in a variety of planning efforts, has been cited in National Register nominations, and really been a foundation in our understanding of these resources. A couple of years ago, the city used a certified local government grant to hire Kathy and her team to develop an MPD. And upon submittal of that MPD to SHPO about a year ago, SHPO sent us a lengthy list of requested and required revisions to really strengthen it into a document that they thought could be as inclusive, broad, and descriptive as possible. Kathy has been assisting in that effort to make those changes. We have a final set of revisions that are required from SHPO to finish the project. And Kathy's passing does put us in a difficult position to continue to use the institutional knowledge that she had, the energy she had about this, and really a project that she spent the better part of her career working on. And so we know this needs to get done. The timeline for this had been extended a number of times, you know, in part because we were working with Kathy and had the opportunity to have really the expert on the topic continue to build out a great document. But we're looking at resources and looking at options about how we can finish her work, even though we know it won't be Kathy, but really feeling even more obligated and energized to get this thing done and get it done quickly. So I just wanted to mention that. We've come and talked about it before. We're really at the place of final edits from SHPO, but we do think that there are still a few heavy lifts in the document, both editorial and also bringing in some new building types to the discussion. So we're going to be working on that. And we've been in the sort of conversations with Architectural Heritage Center about how we can partner and finish this, hopefully by the spring for review in the summer. And then the other quick thing, two things. I mentioned this very briefly in passing, but I am excited to announce that we have entered into a direct contract with Architectural Resources Group and have gotten the commitment from the University of Oregon's Historic Preservation Graduate Program to do a pilot survey of the Montevilla Main Street area with an eye towards having that be the first addition to the historic resources inventory. We'll have to have the new code language adopted before we can bring new resources onto the inventory. But the Montevilla Neighborhood Association asked City Council back in the spring for funding to update the inventory in Montevilla. We didn't get the City Council funding that was requested, but what we did find is that there were some leftover contract dollars in 2018, 2019 that we could carry, or 2017, 2018, that we could carry over and do some of this work. The survey area is not huge. It's only about 200 or 250 properties, so it's a pretty small area, really focused on the Stark-Washington corridor between 75th and 90th or so. But it's an area that was not included in the 1984 inventory in a meaningful way. It's an area that's seeing a lot of change. It's got place identity, very interested neighborhood association, and it's a geography that's manageable by a group of University of Oregon graduate students. So we have signed a contract to do that work. It has kicked off. We'll be doing the on-the-ground reconnaissance level survey in January, February, and March. We'll do a public info session in January. And in the spring, we'll come back to the commission with a draft of the report. Summer, we should have some recommendations for which properties might get included on the inventory. And then it'll not get dusty, but it'll sit on the shelf. And then once we get the code project adopted by council, we can come back with what would be the first update to the inventory. So we're piloting new technology, we're piloting a land use program, and we're working with a neighborhood that's really excited about it. So staff role will be pretty minimal. We've got a qualified, capable consultant who's gonna be helping us, and the University of Oregon program that's eager to be a partner. So hopefully this is a small, tiny first bite at the apple.
It's great news.
What I like best about it is that it's ammunition that we can use, because this will be the first inventory work that's really been done by the city since the 80s. And it's going to show that in one little section that has never been surveyed, how many resources are actually out there. And it's going to be hard then to say, if we found that in this area, imagine all these other areas that we haven't surveyed, what we're going to find there. So I think it's going to be great at our state of the city address when we're begging for money for inventory work again, to actually have something to show that what we're telling them is true. So
yeah,
I'm really excited, and I think that having the students involved is a perfect fit. And I know last year they got some experience out in the field working on the Laurelhurst effort, and this year we can get them out into a little different lens of looking at stuff. The last thing I mentioned, I know I'm over my time. I've mentioned this several months ago. Bureau of Planning and Sustainability was awarded a grant from Metro to update the South Portland Historic Design Guidelines. They're the oldest set of discretionary design approval criteria in the city. They date to the period of time when that was a conservation district. So much of the language in those approval criteria look like standards. You know, buildings must be this tall or this far set back. They've got some fun illustrations that I like, but that don't necessarily give designers and applicants enough visual understanding of what's going on in the district to be useful. And so we did get a grant to update those design guidelines. We will be putting out an RFP shortly, next couple of weeks, for proposers to not just work on the South Portland design guidelines, but to serve as on-call consultants for this and future work that comes up. And so we will be looking for two or three consultants, one of whom will award the guidelines project to as a first task. The others would be on call for future work that might come up related to survey, maybe building documentation, National Register nominations or amendments, special projects. And so I expect there'll be a pretty hot competition to get these on-call contracts. So if, for those of you who either would be interested yourself or your firm, or who knows somebody, expect, I'll send out an email, expect here in the next week or so a RFP to go out for, like I said, multiple on-call contracts. Not all funded, but this first task would be. So we'll be looking for professional services to help with that, and then other things that come up. So that's all I've got for today. Any questions or concerns?
A lot of information.
As always.
Sure, we'll see
you
soon.
The code.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thanks, Brandon.
Before we continue, I think I'm going to call for a just 5-minute break, and that will.